thanks to Mars for inviting me back. And I guess I was told I'm supposed to talk about the methodology and the solution before you know what the problem is. So that's I didn't include any of the introduction in terms of like what the MRT and everything. So I'm just going to start with the problem and then attack it as we go. So the motivation of this work is the uncertainties in the precise location of the tumor voxels. And basically, if you think about it, you can imagine treating patients in lung tumor. I think that is the easiest case to understand as you're breathing and the lung is moving and the tumor is moving. And what you would like to be able to do is to be able to zoom the radiation to that target so that you get sufficient amount of radiation and at the same time not injuring too much of the normal tissue. But one of the critical part here is that a lot of times because the organ is moving, you may be able to actually put a lot high dose to the tumor, but at the same time you're also putting high dose to the surrounding tissue that is adjacent to the tumor because of the movement. So we would like to take care of that and try to understand how do you actually take into this within the treatment planning model. So the idea of internal target volume is basically looking at there's a tumor, and if you look at all the images of the breathing, is that you take a union of those so that you have a bigger set, and you just treat that as a static tumor. And of course, there has been well documentation about this type of approach is that we may be able to actually target at the tumor and give high dose. But on the other hand, if you have to take care of the normal tissue and not put in too much dose, then that limits the amount of radiation that you can actually put on the tumor. And you're going to see some of the results we get is that not only we reduce the normal tissue radiation, we also increase the radiation to the target, and that's the key of it. So the hypothesis is that if we can actually take advantage of the movement as well as the including that into the treatment planning, we will be able to decrease the radiation to the normal tissue and that we are able to increase the dose to the tumor. So that is the hypothesis. Now, this is kind of a little different than the hypothesis in mathematics, which usually we have a hypothesis or conjecture and then we prove it, right? It's true or not. But this is not just like whether it's true or not, it's experimental. So then the purpose of this study is that trying to figure out how do we incorporate this within a mathematical model and try to look at if this method is robust or not. And we are going to evaluate this comparing it with the existing approaches. So the method itself, we have the 4D CT scan. This is like the CT scan basically you can think of if you're just taking one slide of the tumor and taking the whole region itself, that's one set. And 4D means that as the patient is breathing, you're actually continuously taking those images. So that's a huge set of images that you're taking. And I think the second speaker is going to give a very nice picture and demonstrating how the tumor actually moves. And so that's nice to see that. And one, we would compare the methods with the static PTV. That means you assume the images are frozen at one stage and there's no movement, and that's the image that you use for designing plan. That is what we call the planning target volume as a control, and that is the traditional way of designing treatment plan. Then we also look at the IPV plan where you combine all these images over the breathing cycle and take the union and trying to design plan. And then we also compare two of the what we call the robust planning methods. One is called the underdose probability, and I will explain what it means. And then the other one is probability dose generation. Now, for those that are mathematically inclined, this is an interesting method because these two methods turn out to be a dual of each other mathematically. And then we use SIR to generate the directions of beams and also the inference matrix and taking into scattering in different resolution. So this is one of the approach. This is underdose probability. And here what we're looking at is that at each phase of the images, we look at the voxels. Suppose this is the gross tumor volume. And we are really looking at the tumor volume and trying to determine where this voxel lies. So for each of the slides that go through, the 4D slides, we will determine where each of these voxels lies. And we determine what is the probability of this that is underdosed. That means when it moves, it goes out of the PTV in some of the images, what is the percentage of probability that it's going to be underdosed, and we try to minimize the probability of underdose. This is the target, right? So we want to cover all of them. So the other way of probability dose generation is that now you're looking at all the phases again. You're going to look at, instead of just one voxel and calculate the dose itself in that frozen image, you're going to look at the dose at each of these slides represent the tumor as the patient actually breathes, and you take the dose for each of them, and you calculate the probability around them. That means the time that the voxel is going to stay in this space, and then you sum them up. So that's like, or you put a weight, what I call is the weighted sum. Then in that case, at the end, what you get is the average or the composite of dose that is received by that voxel at the end of that rays shining right, going down right to the tumor. So it is an interesting approach because what you really care about is not that instantaneous radiation. What you really care about is ultimately at the end of the breathing, this is the cumulative dose that is given to that particular voxel, right? And that's what we care about. So the treatment planning model itself consists of the number of beams that is going to generate is about 144 that we have based on computational geometry. We generate a huge number of beams, and then we include the dose of like the coverage for the PPV, and that's usually the clinician will give us the required coverage. We can say it's about 95%, or if you want, you can also have 100%. That's really clinician chosen and depending on different type of tumor. Homogeneity means what is the ratio of the maximum dose over the low minimum dose of the tumor received, and how much is being underdosed. You want to bound dose because you want to make sure that there's not too much underdose in it. Then you want to put upper and lower bounds for the organs at risk here. And DVH, I will show you one slide on like what that means by the dose volume histograms. Many of you already know. And for this, like some of these cases, like for the lung tumor and the liver cases, we have like 7 beams. For prostate, we have 5 beams. So it depends on like the number of beams that the clinician prescribed. And this is a large-scale quadratic mixed image program. I will show you the formulation. And the objective that we use is actually trying to use the normal tissue complication probability. Here is what it means, normal tissue complication probability. That means we are trying to minimize the radiation that is given to the normal tissue, and also we want to make sure that all the PPV actually receive sufficient dose, so then we minimize the underdose probability, right? So that's the normal dose. You want to make sure the normal tissue gets very little and that the tumor gets enough. So that's the, and this is a highly nonlinear term here. Won't have to show you that because MIP is ugly enough, and then you put in nonlinear MIP, it's even harder to solve. So like here, this, many of you have already seen that. This is like, if you look at this, assuming this is like the deposit of the radiation to each voxel from the beamlet IA, and summing all of the beamlets, and this is the weight, this is the radiation that will be related to that. Sum that up means the total radiation received by each voxel P. And that, for the tumor, we want that to be the prescription dose. We measure the difference between the total dose received versus the prescription dose. We control the overdose here. If it is larger, if this value is larger than a certain percentage, like if it is positive, what it means is that we have an underdose. We want to make sure that it doesn't go down below 90% of the prescription dose. If this is negative, this value, then that means it's overdose and you want to control it so that it doesn't go above 7%, right? So it's pretty straightforward here. Basically is that you are counting the volume of the PTV, and this is only the tumor volume, and then you say I want all those that are above the prescription dose to be 95%. Again, this is prescribed by the clinician, and this is only for the tumor volume. So this in general can be a very large system. Just to give you an idea is that for lung tumor we could have about 10,000 voxels representing the tumor. Okay, so and 10,000 is not like the smallest resolution that you're taking. Like it's not like 1 millimeter per voxel. It is actually like 3 millimeter by 3 millimeter. So that's basically how this goes. And then you also have, for those of you that are in combinatorial optimization, then you also notice that you will control the number of beams And you can also use different number of column meter size in your bin, how it goes down. For this problem, we are using the 0.5 by 0.5 column meter size. And then you can control the number of couch angles and Gantry angles. So these are all 0-1. That means it's a yes or no decision to use it or not. So the base volume histogram, this is basically like if you look at this one, this is a very mysterious that we cannot see this one. It's 30% of the lab parotid should not exceed 50 gray, and that's like, this is how you can read that. And that is interesting, and I think Tim can mention more about that. Is that a lot of times, the clinician does not really tell you the upper or lower bound. It's interesting, actually. Maybe telling us the upper and lower bound is easier, but they actually can draw you the curve what they want. That's remarkable, because they are so used to treating the patients, and not only that, it does not matter whether you can achieve it or not. They are telling you, this is what I want. Now, give us something that works. But sometimes it does not work, okay? So that's the dose volume constraint. Now, if you look at the medical physics literature, a lot of those will be actually coupled into a quadratic dose difference and then put it right into the objective instead of putting it as a constraint. What we do here, I do it exactly like the PCV. I discretize all these organs at risk, and then I look at, again, the dose, total dose received by these voxels in the normal tissue, put an upper and lower bound. Here, I look at this one and see how many of them satisfy the 20 percentile, 50 percentile, 100 percentile, and then I control the number, right? As you see, as you control the number, you put little dots on your DVH. And even with that, you know the DVH that we get is not unique, because if you just put some, discretize some points, it could be in a different shape. But nonetheless, that's what you can do. And let me show you, like, basically we say if you want to discretize it into 10 ways, then you can put a dot here, a dot here, a dot here, a dot here. Represent that, and then you put it into your constraints. But obviously, in order for you to actually get the entire shape, you have infinite number of dots. So that means you have infinite number of constraints represented. And it is very big, the problem. You don't need infinite number of them. Just 3 dots, and that's a lot of points for you to deal with, right? Because you have a lot of boxes to deal with for the normal tissue. So the size of MIP is very big. This is just to give you an idea of one photon. Like, that means for, if you don't look at 4D images, you just look at one set of images, you have the number of beams, the number of points that represent the tumor, the number of points that represent each of the normal tissue structure, times the discretization level that you want to represent the DVH, and that's the number of integer variables. And then you have continuous variables, the number, total number of beamlets, and the total number of the points representing the tumor. And then you have a whole bunch of constraints, basically depending on how you want to set up. So this is for one set of images. And if you want to do the 4D, that means now you take all the images together, then you have multiple faces for the entire breathing instead of just one frozen face. So this, I don't think we have to convince you how hard or how large it is. For the regular one, just for single frozen face, then we have about 500,000 to 500,000 by 500,000. It's gigantic. So if you want to know how hard are those quadratic programs, they are very hard. If you use the commercial systems that is out there available, you cannot solve those instances in one whole month. So those are very hard, but we actually solve them very fast. So that's the interesting thing about, like, some of the techniques that we have. So the, some of the problems that we are entangling or just having to deal with is the fact that the problem is very dense, and if you look at all the systems that is out there, we are not talking so much about the LP relaxation per se, because MRT LP relaxation can still be very hard, but we can actually handle it with interior point solver quite well. But the MIP solver is really the critical part, is because we have to deal with discrete variables. One of the things that you can actually remove the discrete variables is first setting all the beams that you want right at the beginning. That means you pre-select them, just like what is being done in the clinic. 2, just remove all your PTV coverage constraints, so you remove all the integer variables there. Then you also remove all the discretization for the DVH. Basically, you remove all those constraints that require discrete variables. But then still, it's not like it's not optimal in a sense, because we actually get much better solution if we can actually control the deviation, how far you can push it. So a lot of the advances that have been in the IP area or even interior point solver is that it's very sparse, and partly because all the industrial applications, very different from cancer research and medical diagnosis, is that the sparsity of the matrix is like a lot of times less than 1%. If you look at the classical vectorization of these dense matrix, and you will know that it failed many times. For those of you, if you have run it on CPLAS, you will notice classical vectorization failed because of the dense columns. So now the rest of it, I'm going to talk about this is really the hardcore mathematics part on the what we are doing in terms of the hypergraphs. So we are looking at MIP, looking at new theoretical results, and trying to come up with ideas that will help us to solve these instances. So let's look at a general integer program. This is what we call the integer program with the constraint matrix AX less than or equal to B. And let's not worry about the quadratic size. Just look at the linear size, C transpose X, subject to AX less than or equal to B, and looking at all the discrete variables. So I'm going to talk about the concept of conflict graph. Conflict graph in this setting is that for each of the variable X correspond to a vertex in the graph, and two variables will have an edge correspond to it if they cannot both be one in the feasible solution. Okay, so that's basically, you can generate a graph out of that. So conflict hypergraph is more complex. Now, because if you look at the conflict graph, is that we actually, each edge has two vertices. And conflict hypergraph is that for every variable that corresponds to the integer program is a vertex, and an edge consists of vertices. Set of vertices is of two vertices. And this set of vertices is such that they cannot all be one in the resulting problem. And basically, in the integer programming setting, we call this dependent set. That means none of them all can be one. Now, you can think of it as the following. If you have 10 beams, what you are interested in is that if your final solution only has 7 beams, then everything that is a combination of 8 is going to be out of the solution set, right? So that's basically like, that's what you call that, the dependent set. So the minimal dependent set puts on a special significance. So this gives you an idea, like I said, this is really the mathematics side, and I don't think this is meant to be a lecture for the medical colleagues, but sometimes they love to see all the numbers. And you guys are very good, right? Because a lot of the physics, like a lot of the mathematics and the algorithms, like simulated annealing, one thing in optimization is developed by physicists. So you guys are very good in the mathematics, so I will talk about that. So the constraints set here is that the sum of all these variables, these are all one variables, okay? So you can think of it like a dose matrix, right? It's like X1, this is the beam, whether you can use it or not. Sum up all less than equal to a certain value. And all these guys, 0, 1. So the vertex here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And some of the edges is that, like, for example, if you look 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, is a 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. All of these, if you put them to be 1, then it exceeds the, it would be 11, and it exceeds 9, right? So it cannot be all. So this is an interesting thing about the graph, a very sad one. This is, an interesting thing is that every time we draw a graph, we always need to look at it. And I told my students, I think we must show this graph as ugly as it looks. This is the edge, right? So it is a very fat edge, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and then you got all this. So all of this tells you that inside there, you cannot have 5 to be all selected. You can only select 4 of them, right, at most. So that's what it means. So this type of concept is actually interesting as I look up the literature. 1993, Manfred Pebert, one of the fathers in integer program, is that he actually developed intersection graph that shows the two variables cannot both to be one at the same time in a set packing problem, and that the matrix is all 0 and 1. And then Conigliore and Susano actually extend the result in 1989. And then I have extended this result to a general matrix. That means the matrix can take on any type of coefficient, not just 0, 1, in the 1994. And then Roth from Berlin, he extended to set coverings in his thesis. And then Elper extended to mixed integer programming. Now, interestingly enough, this one, and this one, they are all theses that comes up with the research on that. I believe that this is also the thesis. I'm not 100% sure. But then hydrographs basically started in 1983. Sekiguchi actually developed a very beautiful theory in this area. Much of it is really not known by the colleagues, but then Anna and Laurent and our group, and we have been extending some of this result. And it really is until when we actually look at it and actually develop a lot more greater results that we actually implemented it in its program. Much of the study so far has been theoretical. That means it's not trying to solve it. And you will know why you don't want to solve it, because it is really messy. So some of the results, hyper host of anti-host, click webs and anti-webs. So if you don't know what these are, we will look at them. Actually, look at them as a. So this is odd holes. Odd holes means that it is a hole that has odd number of edges. Okay, so that's just. And an anti-odd holes is just that you just take the complement of this. That means everything that is not connected, you connect them. So that's. And then clicks. That means every pair connects to each other. So that's the clicks. Then we have the wheels. No, this is the web and the anti-web. So these are the structures that we actually could find theoretical results for. And basically what we actually could come up with is the idea. Let's look at this one. It's easier to see. Is that we are going to shrink this guy. Oh, maybe this is not. Yeah, that's okay. We're going to shrink this guy into one node. We're going to shrink this guy into one node, which in this case there's really just one, and connect them as an edge. So we're going to make it into a reduced graph. And here you collapse them into one node, and you collapse them into one node, and then you connect these two. Right? So you can make it into a simple graph instead of a hypergraph. And that's how we find the result. So if we actually do that, this is what we find in developed inequality. That means the number of ones that you can choose in this set, in this special structure that you have, can be at most as big as the size, the cardinality of the number of vertex there, minus the independent set vertex packing of the reduced graph. Okay, so now this is interesting. If you look at it, if you're selecting beams, that means like if you have all these beams that you have to select, it's going to tell you that at most how many you can select out of this set. So it's very powerful because it controls the size of your feasible region. And that basically, this is all the theoretical results that we have obtained so far. And I won't go into detail, is that computationally this is very ugly. My students can tell you all the miseries that they have. And it's funny too. Sometimes I think they really hate me because I say, okay, now figure out how to do the implementation. They come back with an implementation. Of course it does not work. And I told them, why don't you try this? And they said, why don't you tell us this is how it works? They don't want to fail at the beginning. As if you don't try, then you don't appreciate how it works. So, and it's a funny thing, I don't really know, like, what is the, sometimes it really is interesting because I don't expect, I don't expect that their method will always fail, and I don't expect my method will work, but as it turns out, they just prove that over and over again, that my method is always better than their method, and they just absolutely hate it. Until they graduate, and they're happy. So but now they are able to really generate really beautiful results, but it is a complex. I should mention that conflict graph results is already very hard to implement. If you look at CPLEX, one of the most powerful optimization systems out there, it took them 5 years to get the conflict graph cutting planes well. And even that, it is not in the default setting because it is extraordinarily expensive to set it work on industrial problems. So you can appreciate this is a lot more intensive than conflict graph itself. So example, and this is just a tiny little example to show you. This is the conflict graph, how it looks. So you see, right, there's the odd cycle here. There's the odd, that is the click here. There's another click here. So it looks quite nice. And conflict graph works well, or hypergraph works well when you actually have a dense matrix. You get a huge amount of these structures. So just to give you an idea, if you're interested in solving the IP, is that if I add the cuts from those structures, that's the LP relaxation value without the cuts, and with the cuts it improves a little bit. With the second cut it improves a lot more. With the third one it's not even violated. Right? So they're not always the same. And then with one and two it's still that. So two is good enough. If you ask me which one is good to add, we really don't know. Right? A lot of times we go after the ones that have the most violation. That means it improves the best in the LP objective. But it's not clear you have look at disjunctive because sometimes it cuts off just a tiny little bit and it works really well. So another one, another pretty dense little guy here, that's the odd cycle. Now, this is not a hole, but it is an odd cycle. So that means the structure is facet, is not facet defining, but just valid. So this one, again, it tells you that of all these 15 beams, you can only select 7, or of these 10, you can only 11, and of all these 10, you can only select 7. Then we look at the Abbe relaxation here, and then it cuts off the solution rate. So it looks pretty good. Now, I should mention why they're good is if you actually put this into CPLIS, you will generate tens of thousands of knapsack cuts, and nothing happens. So you won't go anywhere. So this is pretty remarkable at 2 cuts. So that's the, if you're interested in the theory, that's the paper that we have with all the theoretical results, with no computational part in it, and because there are other papers that we actually put in the computational part. So the computational challenge, like I say, is the separation routine. How do you generate the graph, and how do you actually find the cuts? So, and I'm not going to talk about this in detail, is that one of the things that we want is to generate the hypergraph on the fly. That means you use the LP relaxation approach, and then you generate the structure. Very expensive structure. You separate the odd holes using breadth first search, and you use separation of the clicks by heuristic approach. Now, I should mention, separation of odd holes, there exists polynomial time algorithm that is exact. But there does not exist algorithms that find all the odd holes. You can find one, but you cannot, or you can find some, but you don't find all of them. Separation of clicks is NP-complete and NP-hard. That means you cannot find polynomial time algorithms to solve, to find these clicks at all. So implementation idea, basically find covers of the constraints, and then we build it by iterative method. Like I say, I won't go through that into detail. But one of the things is that we find the one with high violation. That means from the LP relaxation value, we locate a cut that cut off the most of its value. Now, how does it work in the result? After all the hard work and trying to dissect the little matrix or the very big matrix into pieces. So this, let's look at, we look at about 15 cases that we have looked at. 5 of them are lung tumor, and then 7 of them are liver cases, and then some of them are prostate cases. So I will just show you the results here. This is the lung cancer cases. We have the prescription dose is 63 gray, and the constraint is that we want to make sure that 95% of the tumor is covered. There's the dose volume histograms that we want is that the tumor cannot be underdosed by 10% of the prescription dose. Spinal cord, 45 gray is the maximum. We want to make sure that the V20 of the lung is less than 10%, and then V10 is less than 20%. Now, for this particular patient, the heart and the esophagus is very close to the tumor, and in this case, we want the mean dose to be as low as possible. So what we see is very interesting. First, if you just use a frozen image, that means you don't take the 4D images, you get about 91 to 96% coverage. Not bad, because you're going to see a lot worse in the later case. And the minimum dose is 67% of the prescription dose. So I guess Tim can tell you if this is good or bad. That's probably not very good, because usually the clinician would kill us if that's what you get, and then they say we have to do much better than that. And then if you look at the ITV, this is the one combine all the tumor as the patient breathes, it gets over 95% of coverage. The underdose as well as the probability dose generation both achieve 95% of the coverage. The minimum dose is 97%. So this is the good news, because you basically close up the minimum dose, right? That's what we want. And you know this is a guarantee, because this covers all the tumor in every single phase. So that's always a guarantee for ITV. What we don't know if it is guaranteed is these two methods, can it cover enough of the tumor? And it delivers more dose to the PTV in these two methods than in ITV. And I will show you some of the things. And then it also improved the conformity. That means it's tighter in dose. So this one, terribly busy here. But this is like as the patient breathes, the different organs that's in different places. So let's see where the plans are. This is the probability dose generation plan. This one, the underdose plan, and this is the ITV plan. So you can see the difference in the, it's very difficult to see all of them. I'm going to show you a cumulative one. Basically, it shows you how they differ from each other, and some of these differs by a lot, right? Like this one, you can see the dose difference. Now let's look at the cumulative dose and also the statistics. This is the esophagus. Esophagus mean dose, this one is 8.5 to 8.8. Esophagus mean dose for the IPV is 8.6 to 8.9. Underdose probability is extraordinarily low, and the esophagus is right next to it. The heart, again, we care about the heart here. Max dose here is 27 all the way to 39. This one, 47. This one you can see a huge amount, right? And that's, the mean dose is a lot higher than the mean dose of these two. But you see this guy wins in most cases, right? In the esophagus as well as in the lung, the mean dose is very low. And then we look at the right lung. This is the healthy lung, and the dose is also lower. The mean dose, here you see the mean dose is higher. Mean dose is lower, right, in the same thing. That's the face, this is the breathing phase that we indicate. So now, if you look at, just look at one, if I'm showing you the underdose probability plan and the ITV, here what you see is the difference between the esophagus, right? So this is the esophagus dose corresponding to the ITV. This is corresponding to the underdose, and it's very, very low. And this is the heart. That's the ITV. That is the UDV. So that's basically what we see here. We see several advantages. First, the static plan is eliminated because we have too high of an underdose, and the clinician will not accept that. But what you see is that if we compare these two plans versus the ITV, it has good coverage, it gives you improved conformity, it has lower minimum dose, comparable minimum dose to PPV, and more importantly, it actually drastically reduces the organs at risk, especially the heart, the esophagus, and the normal lung. And if you look at the percentage, this is pretty significant. It's basically you see the heart, the mean dose is reduced by 20%, and the max dose and the mean dose of the esophagus is like 70%. And so that's an interesting thing, because for this particular patient, when we actually received this case from the clinician, they really told us a million times the heart and the esophagus is what we care about, and can you do something about that? And we see that uniformly in many of the plans, we can do really well. Not all the tumor in the lung are close to the heart, and close, I mean, it depends on which side of it, and also close to the esophagus, but some of those we try to use that. So, I guess I do want to mention, because one of the clinicians said, well, if you give them those, and you give higher dose to the PPV, then the dose must go somewhere. Yes, the dose did go somewhere, is that you compensate for the decrease in some of these organs, is that the spinal cord get a little bit higher dose, from 6.8 rate to 6.9 and 7.5, which is very low and acceptable. So if you look at the liver case, now liver cancer is very hard to treat, and this patient I'm showing you has a very large tumor, and you're going to see exactly what's happening. So we are putting 35 gray to this tumor volume, and we want the prescription dose to be the following for the organs at risk. So basically we want to retain the functionality of the normal liver. So that's basically, we want the dose to be as low as possible then. So again, we do the same thing. Now this one, you see a huge difference. The coverage, and it is so bad. The coverage actually is only 67% and 96% as the patient actually breathes. Minimum dose is only 3%. I don't think you need a clinician to tell you that you won't accept a plan like that, because that's really very little. Even accumulated dose doesn't give enough. Then if you look at the other plan, it's that you get pretty good coverage, 95%, and the minimum dose is 93%. And the reason why this one actually turns out to be so hard is because the tumor is almost one-third size of the whole organ. So it's a very big tumor. Compared to the lung cancer, it's not as big. So we want to, in the plan that we have the robust planning, we actually deliver more dose to the PPV than the ITV plan, and we have more confirmed. Now, you always have more confirmed plan in this. Part of the reason is because, as I say, this guy is like a mathematician, can appreciate a union, right? A union will always be larger than any of these little segments, so you tend to always dose more. But this would have worked perfectly if you don't have to worry about the normal tissue. So that's really the key. So again, this one, show you just some of the dose here, so you can see like how low the dose is for the probability dose generation. But I don't know, the physics seems to like graphs, and I seem to work better with numbers, because when I see the numbers, I know exactly what's happening. When I see the graphs, it's not as clear. Now, here's the liver. I think this, I don't remember, this case actually, this tumor is probably from Washington University. I don't remember whether where it comes from. Here is the liver, right? As you notice, it's a very big tumor here. And this is the tumor region. And this is the IPV. The IPV is the little outside that. So this is the IPV plan. So it is just cover a little bit more. And you wonder why it covers outside, because of course you have you cover the entire space. And you, it's that mathematically we don't get the precision of having like a manifold that would just be conformed to every single dotted of this this volume. We can't do that. So now this one is the probability dose generation. And it looks pretty good. You actually see a higher dose here because all these are the same dose distribution color. And then you see the underdose probability. It also covers really well in here. And then it has a little bit outside. Now, I forgot to show you the one for the PDV, but it looks so bad. Like I say, some of the slides only have like only cover 3% of it. So you don't need to see the worst one in order to appreciate the good ones, I think. So the liver cases that we noticed is that both of these robust planning versus the IPV plan is that we can get good coverage. We actually even get higher PDV dose this time, which is very appealing, and we get very good conformity to the PDV. We reduce the normal tissue complication to the normal liver as well as the surrounding tissue. And basically the normal liver tissue has a reduced mean dose. And this is actually, again, there's a little compensation. I guess everything that we don't want, it flows a little bit more to the spinal cord. Seems all right. So in summary, what we see is that the two methods actually work really well. We tested it on a wide variety of patient cases, and it looks very promising, and also the physician really likes to use them. So one of the things now, it's very important. The take-home message here is not like, yeah, of course, we worked so hard. I didn't tell you how hard we worked to get these plans, right? But the thing is that what it does tell us is that if you use the images that you collect, the 40 images, because it is already taken, why not use them? You actually can do a much better job in that. So in the liver case and the lung cases, we see that the normal critical tissue is spared, and the mean dose is reduced, and also the PTV dose is higher, and more conformal plan, as well as better coverage, right? So that's what we see. Now, the challenge is for mathematicians is not, of course, it's not all done, although one of the things for mathematics itself here is that the physicists always go so fast, that they invent new technology, and we always have to chase after them in terms of like exactly where can we actually stop, because there's always new imaging modality coming out. So one of the challenges here is that modeling actually could provide very robust method. It is actually usable in the clinic, but it's difficult to actually solve these instances. You would see that you really do need theoretical results as well as computational results to go hand in hand with it. We have come up with, because we have been working on this for a long time, so we do come up with very good plans. Now, it is not clear if these methods translate to all type of tumor sites. So far, we've tested on lungs, on livers, and on prostate. So that could be other sites that, that's a little bioduct that we work on, and a bioduct we work on for so many years, and very tiny little bioduct. So it is very interesting because it is a very small organ, but then we are still working on it. So as you can see, it is really interesting because it's very stochastic in nature, because you cannot just conclude that, okay, all tumors look exactly like this, then all models look like that. But what is interesting is that all these models that we developed are individualized. That means when you actually take in the volume of the patient, you take in the images, this is every one of them is personalized. It's from the individual patient, and it's not a generic form. So that's the challenge, as you see. I know some of you guys work on the robust approach in quadratic programming and clonate programming. So that's like gives you some idea. And this one adds a little bit dimension to it is that you also need to deal with the discrete nature of the problem. And thanks.